Welcome and good morning. You are listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista, California. Bending the Arc is a show sponsored by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, and it's dedicated to being in conversation with people and groups committed to working for fair and equal justice for all individuals, inclusive of all identities and backgrounds. And today we'll be in conversation with Luis Alberto Aviles Vera of Puerto Rico. Luis Alberto is a scholar, researcher, and activist who, among other things, has been involved in the creation of an important report that we're going to talk about today on deaths of individuals due to police use of force in Puerto Rico. So welcome, Luis Alberto.
Thank you for the invitation.
It's good to have you here. So as we begin, I gave a little overview, but could you tell us a little bit about yourself, sort of your work, professional background, anything else you'd like to share?
Yes, well, let me just say that when I went to the university, I was a student in math department. And I really enjoyed studying math. I developed very good quantitative skills, but there was some missing piece in that education that I didn't know how I was going to supply. And it was kind of an interest in social justice. And I'm telling you this because I study math because I was very good in math, no particular reason. And sometimes people do not choose the causes of the movements in which they're going to participate. Later on, I discovered that through public health, I was able to join my strong quantitative skills with social concerns. And I did not know what was public health at the time I started to do a master's degree in public health. And I love it. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, I thought about what a great discipline in which you can have scientific rigor with social concerns, with community participation, and a lot of politics, of course. Yeah. And basically, what I would like to say that since that time, I have been trying to use public health instruments, concepts, methods to try to uncover social injustice in Puerto Rico. Even when people are traditionally educated, I mean, in social movements, you see a lot of sociologists, anthropologists, right, social workers, community organizers. Sometimes people who come from very different fields, like the hard sciences, can make a very important and crucial contributions that other people can't. Mm-hmm. So my point in this is, if anyone here listening have a social concern, please keep on that concern, because eventually you will be able to take advantage of whatever discipline, whatever skills you have at the service of those social movements.
Mm-hmm. And how did you first become involved in issues related to criminal legal system reform or criminal justice more broadly?
I will tell you that it was almost, actually, I will say, because of the radio. Let's start with that, the power of the radio. Let's say that in the left in Puerto Rico, people tend to know each other. That's quite common. But when a group of friends are together, you don't go exactly asking what specifically are you doing in every single instance in your life, no? So I met this woman that I knew before. She was working on police violence, but I didn't know she was doing that. And then 1 week after, I listened to a radio station. She was interviewed, and I say, we don't talk about this type of issues in our conversation when we're specializing in San Juan. So I offer myself, and I say, I want to work with you. I am a professor of public health. I listened to your radio interview, and let's talk. Maybe I can be of help because I have good quantitative skills. She could not believe that because I was offering myself. And then I bring with me a master's degree student in epidemiology. And eventually, the epidemiology student started to work with her in this project trying to document police violence. And I will say it was by accident. I was not looking for that. I was not imagining that I was going to do something like that. And it happens in that way. The power of the radio.
Yes. Well, and it's, you know, it's interesting because the report that we're going to talk about right now really does make that case for why violence, deadly use of force is a fundamental public health issue. So and integrated with so many other health issues. So the report that we've been talking about is titled License to Kill. And the I'll just read a little part from the introduction. It said, or in the later in the introduction, use of force deaths are not an inevitable consequence of policing. They are instead a problem that can and should be attended to by way of governmental and civil action. This report presents police of force death as priorities in the public policy agenda for public safety, public health, and human rights in Puerto Rico. So tell us a little bit more about the report itself. How did the idea for the report come about?
Actually, this is a very interesting story. My boss in this organization, Kilometro Cero, that I won't want to talk about later on about this organization, say, Luis, we need to do a statistical analysis on police killings in Puerto Rico. And I say, no way. I'm a statistician. We don't have enough cases of that. And he said, no, but Luis, we need to do it. We don't have enough cases. We can describe whatever is there, but we cannot do a statistical analysis. And it happens because, obviously, the police department itself was underreporting police deaths. And because of the underreporting, there were too few cases. I'm not neglecting in this case the importance of just describing some particular instances of police killings in Puerto Rico. But for a statistical analysis, I say, no way. So one of the things that we started to do was to, with epidemiologists that I just mentioned, a student and other people, to try to look at newspaper articles that present some type of killings by the police. And we find it amazing because there were far more killings by police use of force than those officially reported. And I am not referring specifically, for example, to police shootings. But for example, we found, and this is something that I would like to talk later on, two people killed by the police while using a taser gun, the electric discharge pistol.
Right.
And for me, two people killed by the taser is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to find more people. And then eventually I say, okay, now we have enough cases to do a statistical analysis of this. And while I'm going to present some statistics, I would say that we were surprised because we were not expecting those type of things that we found. And when some results, to some extent, surprises a statistician, it means that something really bad is going on. But I must say one additional thing. And I would like to, for the people to the radio audience, to keep in mind that 5 years ago, we have almost category 5 hurricane in Puerto Rico,
right.
Hurricane Maria.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there were two hurricanes in about 1 week that hit Puerto Rico, and the power, the electric grid went down, and with that, people started to say, not to complain, but to present that many people were dying in Puerto Rico. Especially people who were have their health compromised. There was no access to hospitals and roads and to basic electric supplies for, electric machines, for example, for dialysis and things like that. So people say that there is an increased death toll that the government is not reporting. Then a group of journalists presented sue the government to say, we want the death certificates. That should be a public document. It should be available for anyone. And eventually, the courts, because the death toll of Hurricane Maria was so big, actually, eventually the death toll was estimated in more than 4,000 people killed as an indirect or direct consequence of the Hurricane Maria. That the courts say this is a public document. If the community needs to know something about how to evaluate and judge the performance, the duties of government is through death certificates, because this is literally a matter of death and life, a
And so
life and death situation.
they sued to, so that all death certificates would be accessible to the public. Is that right?
Exactly. And then it came to me, since the police records very scattered information regarding the killings, and the press do whatever they can do. If we take advantage of linking the name of the deceased by the person killed by the police with the death certificates, then we have a lot of other information. We have age, education, and especially, and this is something crucial, the place of residence. And later on, I'm going to tell you about this because geography is very crucial for our work. So we have a plethora of information that is available in the death certificates just as a result of a group of journalists the Center for Investigative Journalism suing the state. So we took advantage of that information, and we were able to do this work. So I will say, and this is crucial for the audience, be aware of two things. Even when you have a local, very specific struggle, a very specific demand against government, sometimes in unexpected ways, other social movements can take advantage of that. And the other thing is, in order to make the state, or in this case, the government, accountable, statistics are crucial. And to have open data sources is a fantastic way of promoting accountability. So to summarize your question, so this came as a result of the struggle of journalists in one way, and the insistence of our organization in documenting and started to document some cases that were not documented by the police department, and the particular skills of a group of statisticians that say, wow, what we have here is what people already kind of knew, but we were not expecting that the dimension, the severity of the problem was this big.
Yeah, I noticed in the report too, there was an excellent point made about the specificity of COVID deaths and the data that was collected for there.
Yeah, let me tell you, for example, when you say COVID deaths, the police department was very, actually very good, because the police force, no, the policemen, police persons, they are workers too. And as a worker, they need an occupational health, occupational standards. They need that a protection from COVID or from whatever other occupational condition, let's say. But the interesting thing is that while they're very good in keeping those statistics and make it available, there were some particular statistics that they didn't want the broad community to know. For example, and this is a very interesting case, the case of policemen, and I say policemen because this is the case, policemen that killed their wives, their spouses, or their significant other with their official guns. The police department say, no, 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 those are not deaths due to police use of force. But when you're using the weapon that is provided to you by the police department, it is crucial that those deaths can be also counted as police use of force, because the police department is responsible for arming these, for providing the weapon to these policemen, and also for supervising their use. And those are the type of things that is very convenient for the police to say, these are police use of force deaths and these are not. As statisticians, we must challenge traditional definitions used by government.
And that seemed in the report to be a really important point of departure, to include those deaths and intimate partner violence when a service weapon was used, and also suicides.
Let me jump into some numbers. I know that we're in the radio. We're not going to show statistics and graphs.
But we will link to the report. We'll link
to it. Okay. Perfect. But some information is so compelling. And now that we talk about, you just mentioned the issue of service weapons, but we must deal also with the issue of the availability of weapons. Because the report shows that very clearly. Let me just start with comparing Puerto Rico and the United States in terms of a police shooting mortality rate. In the United States, right now, we're using exactly the same definition. People have been killed by the police using their service weapon. In the United States, and I will say that is one of those records that the United States is not proud of keeping. The rate per 1 million inhabitants is 3. So 3 persons are killed by police shootings for every 1 million inhabitants in a given location. In Puerto Rico, it's 2.1. So basically, 2/3 of the case of the United States. And for us, it is also very crucial to understand that while we have a lower mortality rate due to police shootings, when we compare to the rest of industrialized countries, let me start with Canada, Australia, Netherlands, New Zealand, England, Japan, you name it, all of those, they don't even have one single shooting, police shooting by 1 million inhabitants. So the United States is an outlier, and we in Puerto Rico are unfortunately too similar to the United States and the rest of the industrialized countries, because we need to compare similar things to similar things, lag behind. Something really bad is happening in the United States and in Puerto Rico, that we are too far behind the case of the rest of industrialized world.
And, you know, I wanted to go back to the point you made about underreporting and what you found on there, and that, you know, you made the point, and in the report, it includes that there's underreporting not as much when there's a shooting involved, when the use of force, the death is related to a gun firing. But there were many other instances of death by use of force where you did not find, you had to go elsewhere to find that data. So what did the underreporting look like, and what were the sources of data that you gathered? Because there were many.
Yes, yes. And I will say that we're following in the footsteps of many a social many organizations and social movement in the United States that kind of laid the ground of not only relying on governmental sources, but also using other type of sources. And some statisticians refer to this as open sources information. For example, sometimes we, in a Facebook page, we found something about someone who has been killed by the police, but there was no official report. But since we had, in the case of Puerto Rico, access to the death certificate, we were able to match and link and say, wow, this is true, because it happens in the same place at the same day. Sometimes the information is missing, and with the death certificate, we can find and say, okay, clearly this is the case. So to start with, we're following especially organization of journalists in the United States that are really insisting in documenting police violence. But there are other type of cases, for example, car chases. Car chases is very dangerous. I mean, we know that in Hollywood and in the TV, we see that, and that's fun and it's easy to watch and thrilled. But the main problem with police, with car chases, is that people who are not involved at all in the situation get killed by the action of the police. And this is the type of things that we found in a Facebook page. And then later on, we match information from a journalist, very minimum information, but with the death certificate, we say, okay, definitely, this was a car chase. And the police didn't even mention that. I just mentioned also the case of the taser, and the police do not inform their taser deaths, which are a lot. The case of intimate femicide is one. And one particularly that we must insist, police officer suicides. In our case, all police officer suicides occurred. I mean, they use their service weapons. Therefore, we say in order to protect the police, we should make it clear that the police department should present this type of statistics, because they are responsible for the mental health of their officers. And therefore, this type of statistics do not only document a problem, but it's in the benefit of the police officers too. And I will say, actually with a different method, but a report conducted in the United States, actually, it was a big report conducted in the United States, demonstrated that the underreported of the United States is big too. I'm trying to find what is exactly the figure, but the case of underreporting is very dramatic in the United States too.
Yeah, and it really caught my eye. In the report, you talk about vehicular reasons, other strangulations, things that don't have to do with guns. But when we looked at our own data, which we're still kind of going through, those car chases really stood out.
The specific data in the case of the United States, it is close to 50%. 50% of police-related deaths, let me make the term correctly, of death due to police use of force are not officially reported by the police. In the specific case of the United States, some scholars refer to that situation as an epic failure of the police.
It sounded like it's both due to underreporting and also what is deemed as being perhaps on duty or being directly related to your course.
Exactly.
It's a difference.
Yes, that is crucial, because it's a matter of statistical definitions. And every report can be very rigorous, but it also depends on what type of specific definitions that they use. And in our case, we wanted to have a definition that is as broad as possible. We use a definition that is consistent with the global burden of disease, a definition of police violence, a death due to police violence. But we also add just a couple of them. And one of those is a police suicides, for example. They don't consider police suicides. And in that regard, yes, it is true that sometimes the police just hide because they don't want people to know. And that was what happened with the car chases. But in other cases is that they use a particular definition that is very convenient for them. And that's why we talk about, and that's what the Global Burden of Disease report presents. They talk about direct and indirect death due to police use of force.
Direct and indirect.
Exactly.
You know, the report also focused on something that we're very concerned about here, both in the United States and the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition in particular, and that is the inequities that you found in who the victims of the violence. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about the inequities that came forth in the report.
Yes, and this is something that surprised us all. And I'm going to take just a little bit of time just to explain this. To start with, well, I'm referring to the rates of police use of force deaths by poverty level and racial composition. And racial, let's say. Race and poverty, race and income, let's say rates of police use of force deaths. We were expecting, of course, that amongst Afro-Caribbean people, the race will be somewhat bigger. But we were expecting specifically, I'm going to present some specific numbers now, but I want to present the overall idea first, that it was not going to be that different from other poor people. So basically, we were expecting the police is very biased in terms of who do they kill. And of course, we were expecting Afro-Caribbean people is going to be they're going to have a higher rate, but not that much of poor people. Basically, it's an issue of class, of social class differences, and not an issue of race. And we were surprised because the data demonstrated that our perception was wrong. Clearly, the rate of police use of force death among Afro-Caribbean people is higher, regardless if they are poor or if they are non-poor. So basically, in terms of, is this an issue of race or is an issue of class or is an issue of race and class? This is clearly an issue of race. We were not expecting that. We were expecting race and class. No, this is predominantly a racial issue. But let me tell you how did we go there, because it's an interesting methodological issue. And people get surprised. Sometimes we need to differentiate certain things in Puerto Rico from the United States. In Puerto Rico, we don't have a cultural governmental tradition of classifying people by race. In other words, we don't know in Puerto Rico if infant mortality is bigger, is higher among Afro-Caribbean people than their white counterparts, because there is no statistics on that. We don't collect systematically information on race. It's an issue that, well, we're almost the same. People do not use the idea of racial democracy, but that's what is implied. No, why do we need to collect that information if all citizens are the same? Well, you must collect information if you want to document health inequities.
And is it not on birth certificates?
This is funny. It's in the birth certificates, but it's not very reliable. In the death certificates, it's even less reliable, because the people who are providing the information are the family or their friends of the deceased. So recently, and this is the interesting thing about this, in the census, let's start with the census. In the census, for decades, there was no question on race in the census. This is the U.S. census conducted in Puerto Rico. For decades, maybe the last time that there was conducted something like that.
No questions about race.
At all. at all. Maybe in the 60s was the previous, until the census of the year 2000, that for the first time introduced the question of race. Well, the problem is that it was framed in the same issue of the question of race in the United States. And in Puerto Rico, we have lots of shades, let's say. So, oh my God, I don't know what the audience is going to think about this, but we were, especially the social scientists, we started to conduct research on this because the result of the US Census in Puerto Rico demonstrated that we were whiter than the United States. Since we don't have a tradition of asking questions of race, I am aware that people were very cautious about racial identification for the first time. If someone is going to ask you about race, if this is going to be used against you because of prejudice. So I think that we were maybe 85% people classified themselves as white in the year 2000 census. I have the data, I don't have it here. And we were whiter than the United States.
Right.
So, but okay, things started to change. And since the year 2000, the year 2010, and then now in the year 2020, the people who start classifying themselves as Afro-Caribbean or Black or mixed race increased dramatically. But the local, that is in the US Census conducted in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. but the local government does not do that. And we have asked at the police, how do you classify someone? Oh, it's the perception of the police officer who shoot someone or arrest someone. So basically, maybe I'm extending this, but this is crucial. Since we don't have the experience of classifying people by race, we were not able to use the certificates to document if Afro-Caribbean people were being killed at a higher rate than their white counterparts. And then we use the direction, the address that appears in the death certificate to divide neighborhoods in Puerto Rico. And we divided the neighborhoods between racially diverse neighborhoods and predominantly white neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So in that way, we're not asking the person, we are not obtaining individual information from the person, but we have, because of the census, information of where do they live. And this is the actual situation. If you live in a predominantly white neighborhood, it doesn't matter if you're poor or if you are not poor. Basically, the rate of police use of force death is the same, 2.2 deaths per million persons. But if you live in a racially diverse neighborhood, if you are not poor, the rate is 3.3, basically 33% higher. And if you live in a racially diverse neighborhood that is poor, you have 4.8 rate of being killed, basically more than twice the rate of the predominantly white neighborhoods, which are also poor. Basically, this is an issue of race, not of the race of the individual, but this is even worse, of the race, well, I'm not going to say worse, but it has a different dimension, of where people live, basically the neighborhoods in which police are killing people are clearly perceived as racially diverse by the police officers.
So I want to make sure I understand one thing. So
yes.
as a sociologist, that's fascinating to me. I always talk mm-hmm. to my students about how census categories, you know, change. But it sounds like you're saying because the particular racial ethnic data was unreliable, sometimes on visual or sometimes from a friend, or that the proxy you all used is the location of where the force happened or the address of the person where they lived.
where they live, where they live.
Okay. And that the more racially diverse areas were those where more victims of police violence were from.
Exactly. But to a dramatic increase, because it's the risk of being killed by a police in a racially diverse area is twice the risk of the white, predominantly white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I mean, that's a dramatic, in epidemiologic terms, it's a big difference to have twice the rate is big.
Mm-hmm.
And we were surprised by this, actually very surprised.
And that was the geographical differences that you mentioned
Yes,
earlier.
exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Were there other inequities? I know that many of the people who died were men. That's very similar to the United States. Were there other inequities?
Yes, I would like to say, well, of course, men, as you say, I would like to say, and this is something that does not appear exactly in this report. We're just working because, as I mentioned to you, sometimes we don't have enough data. And now that we're getting more cases with the years, we were very surprised of a key difference from the United States and Puerto Rico. And is the rates of police killings of minors. In the United States, it's something very clear. Minors killed by the police have a lower rate than, let's say, young adults. But what we just found in Puerto Rico is that minors were killed at a higher rate than young adults. We still don't know how to understand that. We're in the process of trying to discern that. But I don't know of any other place in the world where that happens.
And
we were surprised.
18 or younger?
Let's say because of demographic, 19 or less.
Okay, 19 or less.
19 or less. When you compare that to 20 to 24, well, actually, no, let's say 15 to 19. Mm-hmm. When you compare that to 20 to 24, in most places, in the case of the United States, 20 to 24 has a higher rate of being killed by the police. But for some reason that we're still trying to find. And it's interesting because we get some data, but it doesn't mean that we can make sense of that data. We still are thinking about these type of things. We should not be proud when the rest of the industrialized world have far fewer police shooting mortality rate. But when we consider the availability of guns in society, now we can say that the United States is an anomaly to start with. This is a situation that has no parallel in the rest of the world. The case of the United States. In the United States, there are 121 firearms in civilian hands. I'm not talking about military arms or the military or soldiers or whatever, or the army. Referring to civilian hands, 121 weapons per 100 inhabitants in the United States. Is the only country in the world where you have more weapons than population. There is no other country.
And I noticed it really stood out because of where I live as well, that one of the policy recommendations in the report was to and I'm not remembering the exact language, but to be careful about facilitating the acquisition of guns citizens for the purpose of reducing use of force incidents and for the protection of law enforcement.
Exactly. And this is a key issue because I was talking about police shooting,
but
we must keep in mind that if there is an ample availability of weapons in the population, it is reasonable that police will think that person can have an arm and they can shoot me. I mean, that is reasonable. So the wider the spread, the more availability of weapons in the general population, it's not protecting the population. Well, to start with, it's not protecting the police to start with. I mean, we will start from that assumption, but also it's not protecting the population. And this is one of the things that we consider that explain why we have a lower police rate, mortality rate of police kill of police shooting killings in Puerto Rico, because when we check the gun availability, Puerto Rico, we have 13 per 100 population. Let's say per 100 inhabitants, we have only 13 guns. And traditionally, in Puerto Rico, we have very strict gun control laws. Unfortunately, that is changing, especially because we're following the footsteps of the United States. But in terms of countries, we are kind of the country, if we rank the countries, we are the country number 56th in firearms availability among civilians. And the United States is the first one. So that gun availability in civilian hands is related not only to the idea of the safety of the police, but also the safety of the population. And this is kind of a basic public health knowledge. Firearms do not protect individual, do not protect families, do not protect individual populations. Okay, that's it. Oh, that's a very interesting question. First, oh my God, the police was furious. That report is methodologically unsound. Why do they need to include as police use of force death when police killed, when there's an intimate femicide? Police were not on duty when they were doing that. So that report is biased. But that actually played in our favor, because that's exactly what we were denouncing. That the under report is also because they don't want purposely want to present those type of killings. But what was very interesting for us is that other journalists started to follow suit. And this is crucial because I mentioned to you before that we want to present open data. So the report, if you go to the report, the web page of our organization, that I know that is going to be in the show notes, you can find there the actual data set and a methodological appendix in which we explain every single term, every single statistics, every single method. So the interesting thing is that other journalists started to use that data. And it has been very good for us, because even when the journalists are not doing exactly data analysis, but they found the names of people, of police who are violent. They found the names of people that we have for example, the case of Taser, there was a recent controversy if it was an adequate use of a Taser of the one police in, I mean, a recent case. And it went viral because of of Facebook, specifically Facebook. So other journalists found that that same police who shoot the Taser have other complaints because of some of the data that we have presented in our data sets. So one of the things that we were not expecting is how other journalists are doing that. And there is a specific organization which is doing a feminist investigative reporting. And they have used our data, and they have actually actualized some of our data. And I will say that one of the unexpected results is how journalists are using our data. So that was something we were not expecting. Very good.
Yeah, that's
What I am still somewhat unsatisfied, and I know that we need to make an effort to do that. I would like more people in public health to take advantage of this data. I would like graduate students to take advantage of this data and use it for dissertations, for presentations, because it's an open source data set. They don't need to ask for permission. And specifically because they already, the courts say that this is open information, we make it as widely as possible. People can use it. And my particular interest is to, if more students and more professors present this type of information in professional meetings, we will make police violence a routinary object of public health investigation. We haven't get there. That's one of my particular interests in promoting this.
And has there been any interest or reaching out from anyone in law enforcement or in the criminal justice system? You know, often you find there are people within those systems that are interested in change or different kinds of approaches to public safety or concerned about the welfare of law enforcement. Have you seen any of that?
I will say, well, there are two dimensions to answer that question. Two dimensions. First, usually the police claim this is just a case of few bad apples. So they're not considering the broader structural situation that makes this violence to happen in the first place. And to that, we say, yeah, it's true. There are just a few bad apples, and not all the policemen are doing that, because some police come to our office to validate our report. And especially people who are no longer part of the police, retired officer, came to our office to say, actually, we were quite reluctant in having people come to our office, but so to say, whatever you say, it's true. Let me tell you additional information. And some retired officers came to do that. So that was an unexpected result. But I will say that in Puerto Rico, there is there are just few organizations dealing with this. For example, ACLU in Puerto Rico is also documenting police violence, but they are more interested in issues when they can bring the police department or specific officers to the courts. So they are litigating. And once our organization started to document, they say, oh, we're so glad we're doing statistics. We're stop doing statistics now because we want to focus on litigation and UKIP. So in that regard, there are not so many organizations dealing with that.
Have you had any more connections with organizations related to the death of minors?
No, but let me tell you something crucial. I know that you asked me about other organizations that we have been in touch with. There is, and I will say again, the United States has been crucial. The support of some social movements in the United States have been crucial to conduct our objectives. There is an organization, it's Human Rights Data Analysis Group. I was surprised about that organization. There's basically, well, they're a bunch of nerds. Let's start with that. They are data scientists and statisticians for human rights. That's what they say. And they have a specific section on science and police violence. They are helping us because we are just a few. And those people are so versed in techniques of algorithms and data analysis and data mining, something that goes beyond our capacity. Let me just tell you something very specific. We get some of the information from the police because we sue the police to provide this information. But we also sue the police to provide not only the police killings, but also every report of police use of force. Not only if they kill someone, but if they shoot someone, if they use the taser, if they use a chemical, a police riot, chemical, those instruments, or they use their baton or whatever. So finally, the court decided in our favor, and we obtained 4,000 reports, and we don't know what to do with 4,000. We don't have the availability to do that. So these people, Human Rights Data Analysis Group, because they don't provide us a data set, they just provide us a PDF forms, some of them in handwriting. So they made the worst possible way in which we can take advantage of that information. So Human Rights Data Analysis Group has been crucial. in designing ways of digitalizing that information to make it available. And if not for those people, we were not able to do our work. And I must say, and this is related to how you started asking me, how did I start in this? And I said, well, I was a math guy. I didn't know how I was going to
public
do
health
social.
Guy.
Yeah. So this go back because we found strong allies precisely in those people with highly quantitative skills, willing to collaborate with us. And again, it was almost by accident that we found those people, and we're very grateful. With this, I would like to say something that the United States, of course, has a colonial situation with Puerto Rico, and for generations, our people have suffered. But that's a matter of government. Well, sometimes there are some imperialist attitudes standing among people, but in terms of social organization, we have found so many collaboration among organizations in the United States, willing and genuinely interested in the fate of Puerto Rico, that I will say some of the work we do, if it is not because of the collaboration in the United States, or even some of the methods used by journalists of the United States, we were not possible. We will not be able to do something like that. In the year 2010, the U.S. Department of Justice sued, the United States Department of Justice sued the Puerto Rico government because of the culture of violence of the police, of the local police. And as a result of that legal case, there were some agreements between the police department, Puerto Rico Police Department, the Puerto Rico government, and the U.S. Department of Justice. And interesting, while there were similar situations in other states or other cities in the United States, in Puerto Rico, maybe because that was maybe the first case in recent years, bringing something like that and making some agreements between the U.S. Department of Justice and the local police department, there was no requirement of a civilian oversight board. After the case of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Department of Justice, which is very bureaucratic and very inefficient, was able to make some inroads into making especially city police to accept a civilian oversight a group, let's say, just to evaluate. Right now in Puerto Rico, the police investigates itself. I mean, it is illogical. That's it. So we have had some legislators which are presented projects to implement something like that in Puerto Rico. But right now, I don't see that happening. Regardless, even if we don't think that we are approaching that, that is such an important issue, the issue of accountability. The police should be accountable to the civilian population that it serves. That legislators are going to continue presenting that, but it was a failed opportunity because the Department of Justice didn't bring that. We don't blame the Department of Justice because that was the first case that of Puerto Rico. And it was after that case in Puerto Rico in which they were able to consider and to suggest that and to actually make some police departments do it. And the basic issue of civilian population is not only civilian oversight. It's not only that they have access to the information, but that they have the power to conduct interviews, to conduct a full investigation. And that is what happens in other places. For example, in England and Wales, that is routinary. I mean, civilian oversight. Every time there's a police shooting, a civilian oversight board investigates.
What's the next phase of this project?
Police use of force reports. And the police use of force is divided among some levels. Level four is or a killing or a potential death. Level three is the use of chemicals, if the use of a, I mean, really serious things. So our next project is to deal with that, but we're facing the difficult situation of thousands of records, and we're in the process of digitalizing that. And for that, Human Rights Data Analysis Group came to rescue our interest. So in that case, I am particularly interested in the use of Taser, because Taser is not only potentially, it has a potential to kill, it has already killed two people in Puerto Rico. And I'm particularly interested in that.
What lessons have you learned about doing this work that you can share with others who are interested in these issues in their communities?
We must be aware that democracy is a very fragile thing. It is never too early when we think the police is a threat to democracy. Let me tell you, for example, something very simple. During COVID lockdown and when many restrictions, there were a couple of demonstrations in Puerto Rico, and they were actually very public health related demonstrations. Some people were protesting because of food for the poor. The government should have opened the schools, I don't know, school diners, the
Cafeteria.
school cafeterias, school cafeterias. No, for the broad community, there were money for doing that. Actually, money coming from the US, by the way. But the government didn't want to open that. And they were specific targeted for the police. They were arrested and cases brought against them just because they were demonstrating in order for have food for the poor. Other people were protesting because they wanted some restrictions in terms of tourists coming from the United States, because they were saying in a situation of pandemic, if tourism is widely open, they are bringing the virus to Puerto Rico. And they were specifically targeted by the police. Interestingly, those two demonstrations, which are public health related, I mean, the basic right to demonstrate, to voice your concerns is so crucial to democracy. And the police were brutal, encroaching those demonstrations. For me, it is clear when there is a very minor threat to democracy, we should not consider it minor. Threat to democracy, we should not consider it minor. We might consider it minor. No, democracy is very fragile. So my main concern is, I mean, I don't know, a take-home message, I will say, we must denounce these type of things as soon as it happens.
Thank you, Luis Alberto, for your time and for all of your work. And I'm really looking forward to getting this report out to more people and we'll put in the show notes about your organization and anything else that you want to share with people to link them to. You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Radio from Round Mountain in Bella Vista.